From KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Generation AIDS. Minnesota's HIV/AIDS crisis, reported and narrated by Britt Ahmet. This is part two, 1986 to 1996.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh.
In Minnesota, the number of AIDS cases continues to rise. So far, 18 cases have been confirmed in the state. Another 8 are suspected here.
June 1981. Keith Henry was coming off being a chief resident in St. Louis. It was a tradition for the departing chief resident to give a grand rounds.
I had a couple cases at the VA of elderly patients who came in with terribly high blood pressure, and that was my talk. You know, I thought that was pretty interesting.
He gave his presentation, then sat back in the audience. As a second speaker, an immunologist took the podium.
But then the other talk, name was Mike, and he talked about what was termed GRID.
GRID. Gay-related immune deficiency. The Centers for Disease Control had just published a small article on it in its weekly report that month about 5 previously healthy gay men in Los Angeles with pneumocystis pneumonia and compromised immune systems. The immunologist had that report in his hand, and it was the only published article on this strange new disease that had shown up in the world. And in a dramatic flourish, he threw the paper in the air.
Here it is. He throws it up, and it just fluttered down and kind of landed, you know, really at my feet. And I listened to that, and I'm going, holy cow. First of all, this is a much more interesting subject than mine was. I'm jealous. And secondly, this is going to be a really big deal. I mean, this sounds like it's going to be a sexually transmitted fatal disease.
GRID, of course, was only the preliminary name for what was to be called AIDS. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And it was going to be big, dangerously big.
That pretty much, in my mind, determined my fate. I go, I want to work on that.
In the medical profession, if you wanted to work on AIDS, you went to where the case numbers were high. Dr. Henry's wife was also a doctor.
My wife, who was finishing her family practice training and was from North Dakota, was not interested in moving to like San Francisco, Chicago, New York.
So the Henrys ended up in the Twin Cities, and Dr. Keith Henry ended up at the University of Minnesota Hospitals getting his fellowship in infectious disease.
But I was secretly plotting to become an HIV expert. It wasn't even called HIV at the time, but I was devouring everything that was coming out on the subject.
It was September 1984, and Minnesota's first documented case of AIDS, Bruce Brockway, had died less than a month ago. And that body-sized plot of earth hardly told the story of Bruce's fight to stay alive and to struggle to combat the disease that by the end of 1984 would lay claim to 5,596 American deaths to date. But the fight continued in Minnesota as everywhere else because it had to, for people like Renee Valdez, Bruce's lover, who wondered if he'd been infected and was haunted by the memory of Bruce in his last months, enveloped in the fog of AIDS-related dementia. Hope wasn't going to save anyone from HIV. But in the near future, there would be breakthroughs. But as the 80s progressed and the epidemic showed no sign of slowing down, the HIV/AIDS community would coalesce and find its voice and its power, most notably with the national activist group ACT UP. In Minnesota, where HIV/AIDS cases would jump into the hundreds by the end of the decade, members of the community would look for ways to help the growing number of infected. Sometimes these innovations would come from the medical sector, an AIDS clinic, organized drug trials. But more often than not, these jumps forward would be taken by those grieving the loss of a lover or a friend, or by those who themselves were infected, and hopeful that the breakthrough would finally come true for them. And for some it would, in 1996, with the life-saving drug cocktail. But in 1984, that was an event as unreachable as the future always is, and Dr. Keith Henry, secretly plotting to become an HIV/AIDS doc, was completing his infectious disease fellowship at the University of Minnesota Hospitals.
I spent a month at the university. Frank Rehm was there and was kind of the local guru, and I had the first patient in my career admitted.
The patient with AIDS was a university faculty member.
And he came in with a pneumonia, had pneumocystis, the notorious PCP, deteriorated, and we had some primitive laptop. I remember him, his mind was sharp until like the day before he died, typing, things out still, and threw everything at his pneumonia. He died in 2 weeks, still sharp as a tack and young.
This was what a career in HIV/AIDS was going to look like. Mostly young people, and most of them gay men, suffering a relentless round of infections and complications before finally succumbing to death. Some doctors wouldn't want to put up with that. Dr. Henry did. By 1985, he had moved across the river to St. Paul Ramsey Medical Center, and the freshly minted infectious disease fellow had a proposition for his employers.
I think what the area needs is an HIV clinic. And we don't have a lot of cases. We've got to start concentrating the expertise. And if we're going to be playing a role in research going forward, we got to have that critical mass of patients and expertise.
Would St. Paul Ramsey actually allow a first-year fellow to open the state's first HIV/AIDS clinic?
They said, sure, if you want to do this, we don't have to do it, and there's a need for it.
But there was a stipulation.
They actually sent me to training for public relations training for 2 to 3 weeks. So I actually, learned how to be interviewed and, how to handle press and not say anything stupid.
They were worried St. Paul Ramsey would be labeled an AIDS hospital. Dr. Henry had to learn how to spin his story so little old ladies getting hip replacements, the hospital's moneymakers, wouldn't be scared off. In preparation for the clinic, Dr. Henry traveled to San Francisco General Hospital, where the world's first AIDS clinic had opened in 1983.
And then I actually went out to San Francisco General on two occasions and spent a couple weeks, got to know a few of the people there. But I saw how they had a team, the importance of hospice, because they had the Shanti Project. Community organizations were working with them and spiritual organizations, and you had to put a team together to support everybody. And, they were the innovator for that. So you try to duplicate that in a small town way in St. Paul.
The St. Paul Clinic, when it opened, was called the Immunodeficiency Clinic. Other organizations got involved. Sister Joanne Lucid was there with Archdiocese AIDS Ministry. The Minnesota AIDS Project trained case managers and buddies to volunteer at the clinic. 1950s movie idol Rock Hudson had just died of AIDS, so the local press was eager for stories about this new clinic, which to start operated one day a week. But the arrival of the HIV test in 1985 meant that more people were finding out they were infected. In no time, the clinic was open 2 days a week. St. Paul's STD clinic was just blocks away. As soon as someone was diagnosed HIV positive at the STD clinic, they'd be referred to the immunodeficiency clinic to begin their treatment immediately. The St. Paul HIV/AIDS clinic pioneered that rapid access model of treatment. It was also where Dr. Henry continued research he'd begun at the University of Minnesota on a treatment for a certain type of blindness that could be treated with drugs.
And it turns out that in some cases you can't treat those very well with these intravenous antibiotics because you don't get a high enough concentration of the drug deep into the eyeball, which is filled with like a jelly.
At the university, Dr. Henry had worked with a transplant patient who was going blind. But at the St. Paul Immunodeficiency Clinic, he was seeing HIV/AIDS patients going blind as a result of cytomegalovirus, one of the opportunistic infections.
Another devastating blow to patients who are going to die anyway.
One day, a patient with this AIDS-related eye condition stuck around after his appointment with Dr. Henry.
He actually came up to me in the waiting room as I was leaving. He kind of, I won't say ambushed me, but was waiting for me again to plead his case. And he put his arms around me and then slid down my body crying. And he actually said, Dr. Henry, I'll do anything on God's green earth if you keep me from going blind. So that gets your attention.
Dr. Henry worked with pharmacologists and ophthalmologists at the university to get approval to inject this experimental drug directly into the eyeballs of patients. St. Paul was the first clinic in the world to do this, and it worked. It saved Dr. Henry's patient's sight, even if it couldn't save his life. When a patient progressed to full-blown AIDS, there was nothing Dr. Henry or anyone could do except treat infections and try to delay the inevitable.
One patient, he was in rough shape. He was dying. In fact, he was probably within several weeks of dying, wasting away. And then his sister, I can't remember if she flew in from someplace, but got him tickets to the Elton John concert. And they basically came to me in clinic, and they say that all they want to accomplish left is to go to this, have a good time together at the Elton John concert. Can you help make that happen? You know, it's like, two or three days away. And I said, yeah, I mean, that's, we'll see what we can do. So I remember we gave him a blood transfusion and hydrated him and gave him a blast of corticosteroids, and which, again, if you do that, you can make a lot of people who feel pretty bad feel good for a few days. And he went and actually amazingly had a good time. He had been pretty much bedridden, and he died about a week after that, but very thankful for what happened. And then another patient whose first name was Doreen, we saw admitted through the emergency room at St. Paul Ramsey. We diagnosed in the first day or two five active AIDS-defining conditions that she had, and ultimately required parenteral IV nutrition for like a year. She was very wasted and needed lots of IV medications for her AIDS-related complications, was in pain, and I got to know her and her five kids, quite well, and she spent, a third of her next year in the hospital, but two-thirds not in the hospital. And like I said, would come to clinic and you'd kind of see, the full person and the family. And she had so many complications of AIDS and the medications were so expensive that, totaled up her whole bill and was starting to approach practically $1 million. And when she died, and it taught me a number of lessons. One was just how bad AIDS is that, you're not going to be able to fix the problem unless you can treat the HIV virus and improve the immune system.
Live from Minnesota's News Channel, KSTP Channel 5.
And good afternoon, everyone. Liberace, one of the world's finest and certainly most colorful pianists, died this afternoon at his Palm Springs, California home.
Doctors say that the 67-year-old performer had been suffering from anemia, from emphysema, and also heart disease. Speculation about AIDS had been denied. Fans maintained a respectful...
As 1987 began, there were 28,712 documented cases of HIV/AIDS to date in the United States. 24,559 of them had died. For the first time that year, the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, would speak in public about HIV/AIDS, briefly and in response to a reporter's question. Reagan had been president in June 1981 when the epidemic broke out. So why had it taken 6 years for him to say the words HIV/AIDS? 1987 was the year of AZT, the first drug that actually attacked the virus HIV. It was touted as the miracle drug. Everyone wanted it to be. But was it? The same month AZT became available by prescription, Minnesota recorded its 100th death from AIDS. He was Don Gillis, public affairs consultant, editor of the journal Underground Space, and a Minnesota AIDS Project board member. To David Bjork, however, Don was his partner of 14 years. They'd met in Berkeley, California in 1972 when both were pursuing advanced degrees at the university. How they met was a moment David would never forget. David was starting his second year at the University of Berkeley, and one night he and some friends headed to the White Horse Bar in Oakland, America's oldest gay bar still in its original 1930s location. So David and his friends were seated at a table when in walked this vision.
Dark hair with a big beard and hairy chest and burly, came from a Belgian background in Wisconsin.
He spotted David and walked right up to him and said,
"Hi there, handsome, who are you?"
Don Gillis loved blondes, and David Bjork was as blonde as you could get. But now, March 25th, 1987, Don was dead after battling AIDS for a year. And David thought he'd be following him soon.
I got tested and found out I had HIV. Then all of a sudden, you've got this signal that, no, you're mortal and you're going to die a lot sooner than you thought. Very, very scary.
David started on AZT, the first drug approved for HIV.
And the real problem was having to take it. I think we had to take it like every 4 hours, so six times a day. And you'd have this little case that had your six pills in it, and you'd set your alarm to go off every 4 hours, so you'd get up in the middle of the night to take a pill.
David was among a growing number of Minnesotans grieving the loss of a partner, while also contemplating his own imminent death from the same disease. But maybe this AZT would pan out after all. David assembled a group that wrote a play about their experiences living with HIV. They called it Circles of Hope and Remembrance and took it on tour to schools and churches for the next 2 years. For David, the play was a way for him to process his grief, but also to make the epidemic real for Minnesotans, most of whom had never met someone with HIV/AIDS and knew little more about it than that it killed. By now, the Twin Cities was home to any number of support groups. Surprisingly, none of them yet focused on the surviving partners of men who died of AIDS. Maureen Wells was a volunteer with the Minnesota AIDS Project, when she paired up with a registered nurse and fellow MAP volunteer Frank Lamandola to facilitate the Surviving Lovers Grief Group. David Bjork was brought in at the planning stage to talk about the need for such a group.
As David said, people get tired of hearing your story. Your friends are supportive, but then they're tired of it.
The support group was held in multi-week sessions.
We didn't do an open-ended group because open-ended groups just kind of fade and then new people coming in have a hard time. So we always knew. We started out, I think we started out wanting to do like a 6 or 8 week group. And you don't fix people in 6, 8, 10 weeks. You don't fix people. What you hope to do in a grief group is give people a chance to start, a chance to be heard when everyone's tired of hearing from them.
David was not only a consultant, but also a participant in the first ever session.
After Don died, and it was the same sort of opportunity to, one, talk about it, get comfortable talking about how painful it was, and talk with other guys who had gone through the very same experience, and get support from them, give them some support. And I became friends with a number of them over time because it was easy to do.
You're listening to Generation AIDS, Minnesota's HIV/AIDS crisis, 1986 to 1996. We'll have more in a moment.
Another surviving partner picking up the pieces of his life was Rene Valdez, the lover of Bruce Brockway, the first man in Minnesota to be diagnosed with AIDS in 1982. Rene had met Bruce in 1980, shortly after Rene had left Cuba. Looking back, he figured even then, before anyone had ever heard of AIDS, he might have been infected.
He often said the first time he had sex in the United States with Bruce was probably when, you know, transmission started. He never blamed Bruce in any way because there was no one to blame, but he just acknowledged that that was probably true.
The HIV test wasn't available until after Bruce died. Rene took it and wasn't surprised at his positive result.
He expected it. He expected, since he had been living with Bruce and because he had sex with any number of other men who by then he knew, you know, were ill. He was, I think, surprised that he wasn't feeling ill the way other people were.
Now at least there was this new drug, AZT, which didn't cure you, but it kept the virus from reproducing in your body. People taking it had seen their broken immune systems rebound, so they were able to fight off the deadly opportunistic infections. Rene, like David Bjork, would eventually be on the AZT pill cycle every 4 hours, 6 times a day.
AZT was really a difficult drug to take, and a lot of men, including Rene, felt the drug was as bad as the disease itself.
Not only did he have to wake in the middle of the night, every night, to pop a capsule, he had to suffer the side effects of a drug that had initially been destined for cancer patients until it was deemed too toxic. It wasn't any less toxic to patients with HIV/AIDS, but it was the only thing going, and it really did appear to work. Dr. Keith Henry at the St. Paul Ramsey HIV/AIDS Clinic was one of the first doctors in Minnesota to get AZT in the months before it became available by prescription.
The first paper looking at the benefits of AZT was a little, almost too good to be true, and I'm not sure if you repeated it, they'd get the same results, but patients who were in desperate straits were given AZT or placebo, and the number of, you know, AIDS events or deaths was dramatically different in a short period of time with the AZT group. So it was just approved, you know, nothing out there, we'll get it out there as fast as possible. The level of desperation was intense. I mean, that's what led to the Dallas Buyers Clubs and the Houston Buyers Clubs and the New York and the Philadelphia. I had patients that were buying drugs from all these places, imported from, Eye of Newt, Wing of Bat, you know, basically anything that would work. We basically, the FDA was almost looking the other way because they knew that this is desperate times.
The Buyers Clubs had sprung up because the FDA refused to approve drugs without a lengthy trials process that could last years. Dr. Henry's patients didn't have years, so they imported their own drugs illegally from countries whose approval process was less strict. Then the FDA surprised everyone when it fast-tracked the approval of AZT to mere months. Maybe this was going to be the drug that was going to change the whole course of the epidemic. Rick, Dr. Henry's patient, wasn't expecting to live much longer, so he sold everything in a garage sale and bought Dr. Henry a small Christmas present with some of the money.
And it was wrapped actually in a comic book. The comics from the paper was his wrapping paper. It always made an impression on me. And it was a box of chocolate-covered cherries.
But Dr. Henry also had a gift for Rick, AZT.
Yeah, he was hopeful.
Rick dutifully swallowed his capsules every 4 hours.
But literally, it was a hard drug to take. In the early days, you were dosing up to 6 times a day, get up during the night, cause a lot of stomach problems and anemia, and he would be basically a poster child for not tolerating AZT. I mean, retching, stomach problems within a week. Since I'm not going to take this. That was an example of that. A little bit of false euphoria followed by reality, you know, which drove home, you know, the need to keep working really hard to improve that because there was massive room for improvement at that time.
Still, AZT had shown that you could affect HIV with drugs. The question was how to make it stick. That's one of the questions the AIDS Clinical Trials Group wanted to answer. The University of Minnesota was only one of a handful of sites chosen to run the trials. Dr. Henry was among the doctors enlisted to run Minnesota's drug trials program.
When the university, through Henry Balfour, was awarded a site, that put, you know, Minnesota on the map to be part of a team of clinics around the country that would have access to the early drugs for both treating HIV and for treatment and prevention of the opportunistic infections. And so you're immediately going to meetings at the NIH and rubbing shoulders with all the top people. And so, you know, numbers-wise, Minnesota hardly is on the map, but we're at the meetings with people from New York and Miami and San Francisco and hearing all their best ideas.
And the people getting these experimental drugs at the university were Minnesotans, willing to become guinea pigs in a huge medical experiment, so long as it led eventually, at some point, to a cure. Bill Rowe was a natural-born storyteller who mesmerized lecture halls with his tales of other lives and lands. He was a graying, bearded anthropology professor at the University of Minnesota who punctuated his lectures with puffs from an ever-present cigarette. A member of the Greatest Generation, a veteran of World War II, he'd at one time been a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. Even in his 60s, he had a zealous passion for social justice and for looking out for the other guy. This small, wiry man with a wardrobe of black leather would become one of the leading lights in Minnesota's HIV-AIDS crisis. And it all started with food and a young friend in his 30s dying of AIDS who needed to eat. People living with AIDS tended to grow frail and skinny. They didn't have the energy to cook, and they lost their appetite. Bill wanted to do something for his friend, so he went to the store and bought armloads of the fanciest ingredients he could find and cooked up a storm. When the friend died, Bill made his way to the Aliveness Project, which every week hosted a free community meal for people living with HIV/AIDS. Bill became one of the volunteer cooks. And this is where he made that crucial observation.
There were some guys that had been coming to the communal meal who weren't showing up. And Bill got concerned that they weren't coming, and of course knew and was confirmed that they were too sick to actually get to Aliveness for a meal.
Kevin Wingy would eventually work for the organization. Bill grew out of that observation. Open arms.
So Bill, on his own, because he loved to cook, so I know it was on a Friday, he just made dinner for, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, he said four guys that he knew with HIV, with AIDS, and delivered it to them. That's how it started.
At the time, Kevin had two friends from New York living with him. They had HIV, so Kevin's ears perked up when he heard about this new organization, Open Arms, that delivered free meals to people with HIV/AIDS, and about its founder.
I mean, this is the story I'd always heard and always told. The word quickly spread that there was this curmudgeon, you know, making meals and delivering it, and good, and an amazing chef, and delivering these incredible meals for free on Friday night.
There was that aspect to Bill's personality, too. He put his entire self into his commitments. And bridled when he felt others weren't pulling their weight or when he felt they were steering projects in the wrong direction. This would lead in time to a rift with the Aliveness Project when a disagreement with a board member led Bill to call her in the middle of the night, informing her he would call her every 15 minutes until she resigned. The same night, a second board member received phone calls. Kevin Wingy would encounter this other side of Bill's personality. Later, he became the first executive director of Open Arms. At that time, Bill was no longer in charge of day-to-day operations, but he was still heavily involved in the cooking.
And if I wanted to talk to Bill, I'd have to go into the kitchen because he was always cooking, right? And always, after 6 o'clock, he was always smoking. And so I had to discuss something with him that I knew he wasn't going to like as the founder, but that we had to do. And I can't remember what it was, but I went into the kitchen and he was making soup with his cigarette in his mouth. And the ash started falling in the soup. And so after it happened once, and then it happened again, I said, Bill, your ashes are falling into the soup. And he was so unhappy with what I was saying to him. He just glared at me, took a huge drag of his cigarette, and then intentionally put the ashes in the soup, which was to, you know, the message was, we are so done. I'm not talking to you. And I said, okay, we're done, and walked away. And if you knew Bill, that's Bill. You just know that he's going to do whatever he wanted.
Bill Rowe was a passionate, complicated man whose organization became a meeting place and rallying point for volunteers who wanted to do something that would have a direct impact. And you couldn't get more direct than preparing with your own hands the food that would keep these men and women healthy.
Bill, suddenly he needed help, and so he started reaching out to, I know it was a faith community, I just can't remember what church, and he got a group of church women and said, okay, you know, one woman would, you know, make the salad, and one would make a side dish, and I'm sure Bill always made the entree, and someone would make dessert. They'd all meet at Bill's house on a Friday afternoon and then split everything they'd all made so that they could start serving more people. And so it'd be like a sandwich and a salad, entree and vegetable, and almost always soup, because Bill loved making soup and he made amazing soups.
And on their birthdays, Open Arms clients received a specially made birthday cake.
White House officials felt that the president had to speak out because the disease has become the nation's overwhelming health concern. He sided with his education secretary, William Bennett, and other conservatives who say that the government should not provide sex education to children.
The federal role must be to give educators accurate information about the disease. Now, how that information is used must be up to schools and parents, not government.
From 1983 to 1988, Dean Amundsen worked as a hairdresser at a swanky salon in downtown Minneapolis.
So the Red Carpet Salon was a very happening place on Nicollet Mall down in the area of WCCO-TV.
It was at his place of work where he saw the impact of AIDS.
So at the Red Carpet Salon, it was mainly staffed by men, and young men as well as middle-aged men. And I was there when people began to get sick. People would miss work, and eventually they would wander to the doctor, and by then there was a test. And five men that I worked with died that weren't owners, but they were hairdressers.
The epidemic was growing. As of May 1988, Minnesota had 360 cases of AIDS to date, and 210 deaths. 75% of those cases were in the Twin Cities, and most of them were gay men. In 1988, Dean quit the Red Carpet Salon so he could travel overseas. He was gone for several months, and when he came back, he noticed a change. Gay men who'd already begun to organize because of HIV/AIDS had suddenly become radicalized. Because gay men were tired of seeing their friends die of AIDS, they were tired of going to funerals. They were tired of worrying about every bruise. Is this Kaposi sarcoma? And every cough, oh my God, is this pneumocystis? All the while, the researchers were researching away in their far-off laboratories looking for that cure. Congress was doling out money for research and prevention, maybe less so for AIDS education, because of conservative politicians like Senator Jesse Helms, who thought AIDS education was a veiled attempt to promote homosexuality. But gay men, by far, were doing most of the suffering and most of the dying. And no one who had any power to turn the tide in this epidemic, government agencies, pharmaceutical companies, politicians, were asking gay men for their input on anything, from how drug trials were being conducted to how to reach at-risk populations with safe sex messages. And they should have asked, because men who had sex with men were the most at-risk population. And they were the ones who'd created the first grassroots AIDS organizations. They'd cared for their sick friends. They knew as much about the disease as almost any doctor. And frankly, what the powers that be had done to handle the crisis so far wasn't good enough. No organization better embodied this new, more radicalized atmosphere than ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. ACT UP started in New York in 1987, but quickly spread across the country. It represented a major turning point in the epidemic because gay men and people with HIV/AIDS had decided they were taking control of the conversation, and they were going to use outrageous acts of civil disobedience to get people's attention and to entice the media to carry their messages worldwide. ACT UP's motto was silence equals death. When the pharmaceutical company that made AZT priced the drug beyond the reach of many who needed it, ACT UP spoke out. They took to the trading floor of Wall Street and shackled themselves to the balcony. AZT's prices dropped within days. When George H.W. Bush's administration proved as unresponsive to the epidemic as Reagan had been, ACT UP members scattered the cremated remains of their dead loved ones on the White House lawn. They paraded caskets down the street. They protested outside medical conferences. In Minneapolis, Dean Amundsen was drawn in by ACT UP's aggressive campaign for action.
I had already heard about ACT UP New York City, but I didn't know that people were organizing here. And they had just begun, so I went to the first meeting and was immediately signed up to help organize the next protest. I think at that time we were working on contact tracing.
In 1986, the Minnesota Department of Health had rolled out mandatory contact tracing. Now anyone diagnosed HIV positive was required to offer up the names and contact information of their sexual partners. The department did this to identify possible new cases of HIV/AIDS and to curtail the spread.
It was a bad idea because there were no end markers. They didn't know how far back it could go into somebody's sexual history. They didn't know if someone was lying or telling the truth. It was just a big harassment ploy.
The local chapter of ACT UP also took notice April 2nd, 1989, when a Dutch AIDS educator was detained at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport.
Hans Paul Verhoef, he was traveling through Minneapolis and he had to change planes. And the heavy-handed customs at MSP Airport went through his bags and they found medication and I think they found costume bits and pieces that might be seen as like a gay man would have it. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they found these items along with medication, AZT, and so they held them. They locked them up.
The United States Congress had passed an AIDS travel ban in 1987. People with HIV/AIDS could still travel to the United States, but they had to jump through hoops to do it. Verhoef, who was scheduled to speak at a health conference in San Francisco, had skipped those steps. And now he was in a Minneapolis jail. Verhoef was finally released after 5 days, and the payment of a $10,000 bond pulled together by the Minnesota AIDS Project. ACT UP would ultimately create the most powerful patient rights movement in our nation's history.
You're listening to Generation AIDS, Minnesota's HIV/AIDS crisis, 1986 to 1996. We'll have more in a moment.
How was the HIV/AIDS epidemic going to end? Would it end? Now it was 1995. There was a reason for optimism, because a new administration led by President Bill Clinton had made HIV/AIDS a top priority. As he had since 1987, David Bjork picked up his AZT prescription every month. When he co-wrote the play about living with HIV/AIDS, one of the questions the play asked was whether it was worth it to date again. Relationships took time to build. But 3 years after David lost his partner, Don, he did find love again with Bill Charles, a young doctor.
So even though I learned on our very first date that he had AIDS, I still got involved in a relationship with him. I wasn't scared by that and lived with him for the next 18 months until he died. And it was a lot easier to cope with second time around. I mean, for one thing, Don and I had been partners for 14 years and Bill and I were partners for 18 months. But it was a different time where people were not so afraid of AIDS. And I certainly wasn't nearly so afraid of AIDS as I had been.
David had participated in the first ever session of the Surviving Lovers grief group when Don died. Now he went through it again for Bill. By 1995, David was unbelievably still healthy, and better yet, celebrating his new love, Jeff Bengston, by tying the knot, officially for them, if not for the laws of the land. Living under the threat of HIV for so long waiting for the other shoe, AIDS, to drop, had irretrievably altered David's relationship to his own life.
If you're really starting to think about the fact that you're probably not going to live until you're 80 years old, what you want is to figure out what you want from the rest of your life. And it's probably having the opportunity to spend good time with good people. Or it might be doing everything you always wanted to do, but were putting off. I started traveling.
Rene Valdez was still in Minneapolis, a city that held so many reminders of his lover, Bruce Brockway. Sunbathing on Bear Ass Beach, playing piano, the two of them sitting on the porch of Bruce's house, in the dark, in the nude, smoking a joint, their faces pressed together. Rene, who'd come to America from Cuba in 1980, could finally call himself an American. After 9 years of paperwork and meetings with lawyers, Rene had been granted his citizenship in 1989. That was a load off his mind. But the city was full of ghosts, Bruce's and the other men he'd known who died of AIDS. By 1995, Rene saw his end coming too, says his partner, Alan Lessig.
His T-cell count was basically down to zero, and he managed. He had all sorts of effects and things that were happening to his body, but he still continued to survive through it.
Now, HIV/AIDS was the problem of a new generation. Michael Reinbold was born in 1962. He was over a decade younger than the first group of men and women to become infected in Minnesota. So one morning, when he was shaving and felt the lumps on his neck, he had a pretty good idea that that meant HIV.
So I developed pneumocystis, an AIDS-related pneumonia, twice in 1995. For some reason, and we still can't figure this out, I developed dementia, which is really unusual in early onset of HIV. Usually that's the latter end. It was the beginning of the year, and I was on a temp assignment, and I could not use the keyboard. I could not remember how to type. And then I noticed when I was writing things down, I wouldn't write correctly what I was thinking. And then I started to lose direction in a building, and I would get lost in a familiar building.
Initially, he was put in the psych ward at Hennepin County Medical Center. Then he was moved into hospice at the old Abbott Hospital on Stevens Square Park, until a vacancy opened up at one of the adult foster care homes, Grace House, that only took in people with HIV/AIDS. They were able to get Michael on the right meds, so his dementia cleared up. But his being at Grace House was only going to lead to one thing.
Everyone that lived at Grace House met their end.
This was where he was going to die, or was he?
There was a protease inhibitor developed in 96, and at the tail end of that year, I was put on a protease inhibitor, and it was a game changer.
The protease inhibitor was another one of those drugs that suppressed HIV's ability to reproduce inside the body. Dr. Keith Henry, who directed the HIV/AIDS clinic at St. Paul Ramsey Medical Center, gave the protease inhibitor to Bill, a patient who was, like Michael Reinbold, living in an adult foster care home, waiting to die.
He was in diapers. He had PML, which I won't give you the long version of that, but it's a viral infection of the brain that eats away your brain quickly. The average life expectancy was like 3 to 6 months, and it was a horrible death. And I said, hey, I just got access to a new HIV drug, you know, and you mind if I pop it in your mouth and see what happens? You have nothing to lose. And he goes, fine. And he walked out of there and lived, you know, for 15 or 20 years after that.
The protease inhibitor was used in combination with other HIV/AIDS drugs. The combination of three drugs, a triple drug cocktail, seemed to do the trick. HIV could mutate and outwit one drug, which it had with AZT. It could outwit two drugs used in combination, but not three. Everywhere there were reports of people with HIV/AIDS weeks away from death, suddenly getting better. People called it the Lazarus effect, after the biblical character who'd risen from the dead.
If my career had ended then, I would have been satisfied because I had patients literally who were on a conveyor belt to death, to doom. I mean, he had patients where that didn't work, but a high percent of the patients that were in terrible shape improved and recovered. And in fact, the death rate in my clinic at St. Paul Ramsey dropped 90% in a 12-month period of time. I mean, again, there'll never be another feeling like that, you know, in a lifetime.
In 1997, Michael Reinbold did what he thought he never would. He walked out of Grace House alive. 22 years later, he remains involved in the HIV/AIDS community, raising money with fundraiser bike rides. And strangely enough, he lives in the old Abbott Hospital where once he was a hospice patient.
You know, I don't know. Out of the blue, I was looking for a new apartment. I've been to several different apartments in 2015, and someone said, oh, you know, that Abbott, it was a hospice. They turned it into these great apartments. You know, have you looked at them? And I said, oh, no. But it's kind of like, oh, this place owes me.
David Bjork and his husband, Jeff Bankston, are celebrating 24 years of marriage. They even held a second wedding ceremony after same-sex marriage became legal.
It was nice, and we invited some of the people, a few, very small. We had about 7 people there. A couple of the people who had been in the original wedding in 1995, but just we didn't want it to be big, and we just did it right here in the house, and then went to dinner.
After decades of living with HIV, David doesn't think about it much. But like Michael Reinbold, there are the pills he has to take every morning. The drugs have changed what HIV means. It's now a chronic, manageable condition. Problems arise when people stop taking their pills or take them erratically. HIV is always waiting for an opportunity like this to mutate. The good news in HIV/AIDS today is that now there's the PrEP pill that can keep you from ever getting infected. And the drugs taken by those who are HIV positive keep viral loads in the body so low, there's little chance you can transmit the virus to anyone. Rene Valdez survived. By 2000, he was feeling truly healthy for the first time in years. He moved to the West Coast to start a new life. Finally able to work again, he got a job in the computer field working with Microsoft. And he found love with Alan Lessig, whom he met in 2000.
He was feeling alive again and ready and able, and I wasn't necessarily looking for anyone, but once I found him and found this kind of, again, he was still a very beautiful man. You know, his intellect was amazing. His stories, his excitement was, you know, was practically breathtaking.
But there was that trauma of having lived through the disease. And there was this thing called survivor's guilt. That, along with other challenges, threw Rene into deep despair.
The last kind of years of his life, he would go in and out of depression, and every time he came out of depression, we'd think, oh, it's done. Okay, this is done. But in his depressions, he attempted to take his life a few times. And I'd say, but I love you. And he'd remind me that I know you love me and I love you, but that's not going to cure me. This has nothing to do with you. This is me. So when he finally took his life, I didn't know that, you know, he obviously had prepared for it in many ways and had gotten some of his things in order and his finances and said goodbye to a bunch of people without people knowing he was really saying goodbye. And so we could just be with each other. Yeah, I mean, even in the hard parts, we were still willing to be with each other.
He died February 2nd, 2012. In 2016, Alan Lessig remembered his partner with the novel The Trouble Seeker, a fictional reimagining of Renee's life, including that first meeting with Bruce Brockway and their life together in Minneapolis. So who was Bruce Brockway? That was the question that started this two-part documentary on the Minnesota HIV/AIDS crisis. If you were to Google his name today, pretty much the only thing you'll find out about him is that he was Minnesota's first documented case of AIDS. But he was so much more than that. They all were.
You've been listening to Generation AIDS, Minnesota's HIV/AIDS crisis, reported and narrated by Britt Ahmet. This has been part two, 1986 to 1996. Funding for this program is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thanks for listening.